This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Rake, Boston Bells, Book 4. Written by L.J. Shen. Performed by Joe Arden and Maxine Mitchell.
Prologue. Devon. I'd been betrothed shortly before I was conceived. My future written, sealed, and agreed upon before my mother had her first ultrasound appointment, before I had a heart, a pulse, lungs, and a spine. Ideas, wishes, and preferences, when I was no more than an abstract idea. A future plan, a box to be ticked off. Her name was Louisa Butchart, Lou, really, to those who knew her. Though I would not be aware of the arrangement until I turned 14, told right before the traditional pre-Christmas hunting trip the Whitehalls had with the Butcharts. There was nothing wrong with Louisa Butchart. Nothing that I could find, at any rate. She was lovely, well-mannered, of excellent pedigree. Nothing wrong with her at all, except for one thing. She wasn't my choice. I suppose this was how it all started. How I became who I am today. A fun-loving, whiskey-drinking, fencing, skiing hedonist who answered to no one and tumbled into bed with everyone. All the numbers and variables were there to create the perfect equation. Great expectations, multiplied by crushing demands. Morally divided by more money than I could ever burn. I'd been blessed with the right physique, right bank account, right smirk, and right amount of charm, with only one invisible thing missing. A soul. The thing about not having a soul was that I wasn't even aware of it. It took someone special to show me what I'd been missing. Someone like Emma Bell Penrose. She cut me open and tar spilled out. Sticky, dark, and never-ending. This is the true Royal Rake's secret. My blood never ran blue. It was like my heart, pure black. 14 years old. We rode at sunset. The hounds led the way. My father and his comrade, Byron Butchart Sr., followed closely. Their horses cantered in perfect rhythm. Byron Jr., Benedict, and I trailed behind. They gave the young lads the mares. They were unruly and harder to break. Taming young, spirited females was an exercise men of my class had been given from a young age. After all, we were born into a life that required a well-trained wife, pudgy babies, croquet, and alluring mistresses. Chin and heels down, back, ramrod straight, I was the picture of a royal equestrian. Not that it helped me avoid being thrown into the sweatbox, curling into myself like a snail. Papa loved throwing me in there for the sake of watching me squirm, no matter how hard, how diligently, how desperately I tried to please him. The sweat box, also known as the isolation bin, was a 17th century dumbwaiter. It had a coffin-like shape and offered the same experience. Since I was notoriously claustrophobic, this was my father's go-to punishment whenever I misbehaved. Misbehaving, however, wasn't something I did often or even at all. That was the sad part. I wanted badly to be accepted. I was a straight-A student and a gifted fencer. I'd even made it to the England Youth Championship in Sabre, but was still thrown into the dumbwaiter when I lost to George Stanfield. Perhaps my father always knew what I tried to keep concealed from view. On the outside, I was perfect. On the inside, however, I was rotten to the bone. At 14, I'd already slept with two of the servants' daughters, managed to ride my father's favorite horse to its untimely death, and flirted with cocaine and Special K, not the cereal. Now, we were going fox hunting. I quite hated fox hunting, and by quite, I meant a bloody lot. I detested it as a sport, a concept, and a hobby. I drew no pleasure from killing helpless animals. Father said blood sport was a great English tradition, much like cheese rolling and Morris dancing. Personally, I thought some traditions did not, in fact, age as well as others. Burning heretics at the stake was one example, fox hunting another. Noteworthy to distinguish, fox hunting was, or shall I say is, illegal in the United Kingdom. But men of power, I'd come to learn, had a complex and oftentimes tempestuous relationship with the law. They enforced and determined it, yet disregarded it almost completely. My father and Byron Sr. enjoyed fox hunting all the more because it was forbidden to the lower classes. It gave the sport an added shine, an eternal reminder that they were born different, better. We were heading into the woods, passing the cobbled path to the grand iron-wrought gate of Whitehall Court Castle, my family's estate in Kent. My stomach churned as I thought about what I was about to do. Kill innocent animals to mollify my father. The soft tapping of Mary Jane's clunked behind us, hitting the pebbles.
"Devi, wait."
The voice was breathless, needy. I leaned back on Duchess, pushing my feet forward, pulling at the reins. The mare gated back. Louisa appeared at my side, clutching something wrapped haphazardly. She was in her pink pajamas. Her teeth were covered in colorful, horrendous braces.
"I got you something."
She slapped away pieces of the brown hair sticking to her forehead. Lou was 2 years my junior. I was at the unfortunate stage of adolescence where I found anything, including sharp objects and certain fruits, sexually appealing. But Lou was still a child, loose-jointed and pocket-sized. Her eyes were big and inquisitive, drinking in the world in gulps. She was not exactly a looker, with her average features and boyish frame, and her braces gave her a speech impediment she was self-conscious about. "Lou," I drawled, quirking a brow. "Your mum's going to have a fit if she finds you snuck out."
"Don't care."
She rose on her toes, handing me something wrapped in one of her sensible cardigan sweaters. I tossed her jumper, delighted to find my father's engraved flask inside, heavy with bourbon.
"I know you dislike fox hunting, so I brought you something to, how does Daddy say it, fake the edge off?"
The others moved along, entering the thick, mossy woods bracketing Whitehall Court Castle, either unaware or disinterested in my absence. "You little nutter." I took a swig from the flask, feeling the sharp burn of the liquid rolling down my throat. "How'd you get your hands on this?" Lou beamed with pride, cupping her mouth to cover all the metal.
"I snuck into your papa's study. No one ever notices me, so I can get away with loads of stuff."
The despondence in her voice made me sad for her. Lou dreamed of going to Australia and becoming a wildlife rescuer, surrounded by kangaroos and koalas. I hoped for her sake that she would. Wild animals, no matter how aggressive, were still superior to humans. "I notice you."
"Do you really?"
Her eyes grew bigger, browner. "Cross my heart." I scratched behind Duchess's ear. Females, I'd come to realize, were ridiculously easy to please. "You'll never get rid of me."
"I don't want to be rid of you," she said hotly. "I'll do anything for you."
"Oh, anything now," I chuckled. Lou and I had the relationship of an older brother and younger sister. She did things to try and win my affection, and I, in return, assured her she was nice and caring. She nodded eagerly.
"I'll always have your back."
"Right then." I was ready to move along.
"Do you think you'll ever tell your parents you're vegetarian?"
she blurted out. How did she know this?
"I noticed you shy away from meat and even fish when we dine."
She buried one of her Mary Janes in the pebbles, digging her toes in, looking down in embarrassment. "No," I shook my head, my tone cold. "There are some things my parents don't need to know." And then, because we had nothing more to say, and maybe because I was afraid Papa would throw me in the dumbwaiter if he saw me loitering behind, I said, "Well, cheers for the drink." I raised the flask in salute, squeezed Duchess's belly with my riding boots, and joined the others.
"Oh, look, if it isn't posh spice,"
Benedict, Lou's middle brother, poked a finger to loosen the strap of his helmet.
What was the hold back?
Lou gave us a good luck charm, Baby Spice. I tipped the flask in his direction. Unlike Louisa, who was a bit eager but overall agreeable, her brothers, for lack of better description, were complete and utter twats. Supersized bullies who liked to pinch the maids on the arse and make an unnecessary mess just to watch others tidy after them.
Bloody hell, Byron snorted. She's pathetic.
You mean considerate? Spending time with my father requires some level of intoxication, I drawled sarcastically.
It's not about that. She's obsessed with your sorry arse, Benedict supplied.
Don't be ridiculous, I growled.
Don't be blind, Byron barked at me.
Ah, she'll get over it. They all do. I took another swig, grateful that my father and Byron Sr. were so engrossed in discussing Parliament-related matters, they did not see fit to turn their heads and check on us.
I hope she doesn't, Benedict sneered. If she is destined to marry your shite for brains, she should at the very least enjoy it.
Did you say marry? I lowered the flask. He might as well have said bury. No offense to your sister, but if she is awaiting a proposal, she better get comfortable because one is not coming. Byron and Benedict exchanged looks, grinning conspiratorially. They had the same coloring as Louisa, fair as the fresh fallen snow, only they looked like I drew them with my left hand.
Don't tell me you don't know,
Byron cocked his head, a cruel smile spreading across his face. I never was fond of him, but I especially wasn't fond of him at that moment.
Know what? I gritted out, loathing that I had to play along to find out what they were talking about. You and Lou are going to tie the knot. It's all settled. There's even a ring.
I laughed, metallically, kicking Duchess's right side to make her bump into Benedict's mare, throwing him off balance. What a load of rubbish. As I continued laughing, I noticed their smiles had vanished. They were no longer looking at me with playful mischief.
You're taking the piss.
My smile dropped. My throat felt like it was full of sand.
No,
Byron said flat out.
Ask your father, Benedict challenged. It's been decided in our family for years. You're the eldest son of the Marquis of Fitzgrovia. Louisa is the daughter of the Duke of Salisbury. A lady. You will one day become a Marquis yourself, and our parents want the royal blood to stay within the family. Keep the estates intact. Marrying a commoner would weaken the chain.
The Whitehalls were one of the last families in peerage people still gave half a fuck about. My great-great-great-grandmother, Wilhelmina Whitehall, was the daughter of a king. I don't want to marry anyone, I said through gritted teeth. Duchess began picking up speed, entering the woods.
Well, obviously, Benedict made an unflattering duh face. You're 14. All you want is to play video games and fondle your meat to Christy Brinkley posters. Nonetheless, you're marrying our sister. Too much business between our fathers to let this opportunity go to waste.
And don't forget the estates they'll both get to keep, Byron added helpfully, giving his mare a vicious kick to make her go faster.
I'll say, good luck giving her children. She looks like Ridley Scott's alien.
Children? The only thing preventing me from vomiting up my guts was the fact I did not want to waste the perfectly good brandy currently sloshing in my stomach.
Lou says she wants 5 when she grows up, Byron cackled, enjoying himself. I reckon she's going to keep you busy in the sack, mate.
Not to mention exhausted, Benedict leered. Over my dead body. My throat grew tight, my hands clammy. I felt like I was the butt of a terrible joke. Of course I couldn't talk to my father about it. I couldn't stand up to him. Not when I knew I was only one wrong word away from the dumbwaiter. All I could do was shoot helpless animals and be exactly who he wanted me to be. His little well-oiled machine. Ready to kill, fuck, or marry, as commanded. Later that night, Byron, Benedict, and I sat in front of one of the dead foxes in the barn, the Pavlovian scent of death swathed around the room. My father and Byron Sr. had taken all their prized dead foxes to the taxidermist and left one for us to dispose. Burn it, play with it, leave it for the rats to eat for all I care. My father had spat before turning his back on the corpse. It was a female, small, malnourished and dull-furred. She had cubs. I could tell by the teats poking through her belly fur. I thought about them, how they were all alone, hungry and stranded in the dark, vast woods. I thought about how I shot her when Papa ordered me to, how I nailed a bullet straight between her eyes, how she stared at me with a mixture of amazement and terror, and how I looked away because it had been Papa I wanted to shoot. Benedict, Byron, and I were passing a bottle of champers back and forth, discussing the evening's events, with Frankenfox staring at me accusingly from across the barn. Benedict also obtained rolled-up cigarettes from one of the servants. We puffed on them heartily. "Come on, mate, marrying our sister isn't the end of the world." Byron offered a Bond villain laugh as he stood over the fox, one of his boots pressed against her back. "She's a child," I spat. Strewn on a wooden stool, I felt my bones were a century old. "She's not going to be a child forever," Benedict poked the edge of his boot into the fox's gut. "To me, she will be." "She'll make you even richer," Byron added. "No money can buy my freedom." "None of us were born free," Benedict thundered, stomping. "What's the incentive to stay alive if not to gain more power?" "I don't know what the meaning of life is, but I'm sure as fuck not going to take pointers from a pudgy rich kid who needs to pay the maids to cop a feel," I growled, flashing my teeth. "I'll choose my own bride, and it won't be your sister." Frankly, I did not want to marry at all. For one thing, I was certain I'd be a terrible husband, lazy, unfaithful, and in all probability obtuse. But I wanted to keep my options open. What if I did run into Christy Brinkley? I would marry the shite out of her if it meant getting into her knickers. Byron and Benedict exchanged puzzled looks. I knew they had no loyalty to their younger sister. She was, after all, a girl, and girls were not as distinguished, not as important as boys in peerage society. They couldn't continue the family's name and, therefore, were treated as no more than a decoration you had to remember to include in Christmas card photos. It was the same with my younger sister, Cecilia. My father largely ignored her existence. I always doted on her after he sent her to a room or tucked her away for being too round or too dull to parade around high society. I'd snuck cookies to her, told her bedtime stories, and took her to the woods where we played. "Get off your bloody high horse, Whitehall. You're not too good for our sister," Byron moaned. "That may well be, but I'm not going to sleep with her." "Why?" Byron demanded. "What's wrong with her?" "Nothing. Everything." I poked hay around with the tip of my boot. I was fairly drunk by now. "Would you rather kiss this fox's mouth or lose?" Benedict pressed, his eyes wandering around the barn, behind my shoulder and beyond. I gave him a wry look. "I'd rather kiss neither, you Class A minger." "Well, you must choose one." "Must I?" I hiccuped, picking up a stray horseshoe and throwing it at him. I missed by about a mile. "Why the bloody hell is that?" "Because," Byron uttered slowly, "if you kiss the fox, I'll tell my dad that you're gay. That'd fix everything up. You'd be off the hook." "Gay," I repeated numbly. "I could be gay." "Not technically, no. I loved women too much, in every shape, form, color, and hairstyle." Byron laughed. "You sure are pretty enough." "That's a stereotype," I said, and immediately regretted it. I was in no state to explain the word stereotype to these two morons. "Bleeding heart liberal," Byron cackled, elbowing his brother. "Maybe he is gay," Benedict mused. "Nah," Byron shook his head. "He's already shagged a couple birds, I know." "Well,
Are you going to do it or not?
Benedict demanded. I considered the proposal. Benedict and Byron were known for this kind of outrageous ploy. They spun lies around people and others just bought it. I knew because I went to the same school with them. What was one silly kiss on a dead fox's mouth in the grand scheme of things? This was my only hope. If I butted heads with my father, one of us would die. As it stood right now, that someone was going to be me. Fine. I pushed myself up from the stool, zigzagging my way to Frankenfox. I bent down and pressed my lips to the fox's mouth. It was gummy and cold and smelled like used dental floss. Bile coated my throat.
Mate, oh God, he is actually doing this!
Benedict snorted behind my back. Why don't I have a camera? Byron moaned. He was on the floor now, clutching his stomach, he was laughing so hard. I pulled back. My ears were ringing, my vision turned milky. I saw everything through a yellow haze. Someone behind me screamed. I swiveled back, quickly falling to my knees. Lou was there, at the open double doors of the barn, still in her pink pajamas, her hand pressed against her mouth as she trembled like a leaf.
You perv,
she mewed. Lou, I grunted. I'm sorry. And I was, but not for not wanting to marry her, only for how she found out about it. Benedict and Byron were rolling on the hay, punching each other, laughing and laughing and laughing. They'd set me up. They knew she was there, by the door, watching all along. I was never going to get out of this arrangement. Lou whirled around and bolted. Her tears, like tiny diamonds, flew behind her shoulders. The scream that tore from her mouth was feral, like the one Frankenfox had made before I killed her. I keeled over and threw up, collapsing into the remains of my dinner. Darkness spun around me. And I, in return, succumbed to it. My father handed me a whiskey the morning after. We were in his big oak study with a golden bar trolley and burgundy drapes. One of the servants had hauled me into his office minutes earlier. No explanation was needed. He'd simply dragged me across the carpets and disposed of me at Papa's feet. Here, for your hangover. Papa motioned for the tan leather recliner in front of his desk. I sat, accepting the drink. You're giving me whiskey? I sniffed it, my lips curling in distaste. Hair of the dog. He sprawled in his executive chair, smoothing his mustache with his fingers. Taking the hair of the dog that bit you eases up the withdrawal. I took a swig of the poison, wincing as it scorched its way to my gut. I'd had a sleepless night on the hay in the barn. I kept waking up in a cold sweat, dreaming about tiny Louisa-like babies running after me. The taste of the dead fox's kiss didn't exactly soften the blow either. The scent of black tea and fresh scones wafted through the hallways of Whitehall Court Castle. Breakfast wasn't quite over. My stomach roiled, reminding me that appetite was a luxury for men who weren't newly and unwittingly betrothed. I drained my whiskey. You wanted to see me. I never want to see you. Unfortunately, it is a necessity that comes with siring you. Papa did not mince words. Something quite disturbing was brought to my attention this morning. Lady Louisa told her parents what happened yesterday, and her father relayed to me the situation. My father, tall, lean, and striking, with sandy blonde hair and a neatly pressed suit, drawled with accusation in his voice, inviting me to explain myself. We both knew he disliked me on a personal level, that he would sire new successors if it wasn't for the fact that I remained the eldest, and therefore the heir to his title. I was too graceful, too much of a bookworm, too much like my mum. I'd allowed other boys to dominate me, to make me defile an animal. I don't want to marry her. I expected a slap or a thrashing. Neither would come as a surprise. but what I got was a light chuckle and a shake of his head.
I understand, he said.
Do I not have to? I perked up.
Oh, you will marry the girl. Your wishes have no significance. Neither do your thoughts, for that matter. Marriages of love are for the great unwashed masses. People born to follow society's thankless rules. You shall not desire your wife, Devon. Her purpose is to serve you, sire children, and look lovely. Word to the wise, keep your desire for those of whom you can dispose. It's smarter and cleaner. Commoner rules do not apply to the upper class.
The need to violently smash his head against the wall was so urgent, my fingers twitched in my lap. When I remained silent for several minutes, he rolled his eyes, looking skyward like I was the one being unreasonable.
You think I wanted to marry your mother?
What's wrong with Mum? She was pretty and reasonably nice.
What's not?
He took a cigar out of a box and lit it up.
If she ran as much as her mouth, she'd be in good shape. She was a package deal, though. She had the money. I had the title. We made it work.
I stared into the bottom of my empty whiskey glass. That sounded like a tagline for the most depressing romantic comedy in the world. We don't need more money, and I'll already have a title.
It's not just the money, you idiot.
He slammed his palm against his desk between us, roaring.
All that stands between us and the commoners that serve us is pedigree and power.
Power corrupts. I said curtly.
The world is corrupt.
His lip curled in disgust. I knew bloody well I was close to being thrown into the dumbwaiter.
I'm trying to explain to you in simple English that the matter of your nuptials to Miss Butchart is not up for debate. At any rate, it is hardly going to happen tomorrow.
No, not tomorrow and not at all, I heard myself say. I won't marry her. Mum won't stand for it.
Your mother has no say in things.
His azure eyes darkened into a marbled mirror. I could see myself in their reflection. I looked small and sunken. Not myself. Not the boy who rode horses with the wind dancing in his face, who pushed his hand under a servant girl's dress and made her giggle breathlessly. The boy with the explosive speed and dazzling footwork who made some of Europe's best fencers weep. That boy could pierce his father's black heart with a pointy sword and eat his heart while it was still beating. This boy could not.
You'll marry her, and you will give me a male grandchild, preferably one superior to yourself.
My father finished his cigar, stubbing it in a nearby ashtray.
This matter is settled. Now go apologize to Louisa. You will marry her after you finish Oxford University, and not a moment later, or you will lose your entire inheritance, your family name, and the relatives who, for a reason unbeknownst to me, still tolerate you. Because make no mistake, Devon. When I tell your mother she is to disown you, she won't think twice before turning her back on her child. Am I understood?
My cunningness overtook me just then, as it had the tendency to do, washing over my skin like acid, making me turn inside out and become someone else. There was no point fighting him. I had no leverage. I could get thrashed, locked, mocked, and tortured. Or I could play my cards right. Do what he and Mr. Butchart did so often. Play the system. Yes, sir. My father narrowed his eyes suspiciously.
I'm telling you to marry Louisa.
Yes, sir.
And apologize to her now.
Certainly, sir. I bowed my head deeper, a ghost of a smile hovering over my lips.
And kiss her. Show her you like her. No tongue or funny business. Just enough to prove you are true to your word.
Bile scorched its way up my throat. I'll kiss her. Astonishingly, he looked even less pleased, the tip of his upper lip twisting as he snarled.
What made you change your mind?
My father was both mean and an idiot, a horrid combination. He had more temper than brains, which led him to make many business mistakes. At home, he reigned with an iron fist that, more often than not, landed on my face. The business mistakes were easier to deal with. My mother had taken over the books without his knowledge, and he was nearly always too drunk to realize. As for my abuse, she knew bloody well that if she tried to protect me, he'd take the belt to her too. "Suppose you're right," I leaned back in my seat, crossing my legs casually. "What difference does it make who I marry as long as I can sleep my way into the record books of history?" He chuckled, the darkness in his eyes melting. This was more his speed, having a heathen sinner of a son with a deficit of scruples and even fewer positive traits. "Shagged anyone yet?" "Yes, sir, at 13. He brushed his thumb under his chin. "I first slept with a woman at 12. "Brilliant," I said, though the idea of my father pounding into a woman from behind at 12 made me want to curl onto a therapist's sofa and not leave for a decade. "Well then," he slapped his thigh, "onward and upward, young lad. English aristocracy does not come cheap. One must preserve it in order to maintain it." "Then I shall do my part, Popper." I stood up, shooting him a sly smirk. That was the day I truly became a rake. The day I turned into the crafty, soulless man I now saw when I looked in the mirror. The day I indeed apologized to Louisa, even kissed her on the cheek, and told her not to worry. That I had been drunk, that it had been a mistake, that we would most definitely get married, and that it would be a beautiful event. With flower girls and archbishops and a cake taller than a skyscraper. I played my cards right for the next decade. Sent her birthday presents, showered her with cards, and met her often during summer breaks. I tucked flowers in her hair and told her all the other girls I'd shagged were meaningless. I let her wait and pine and crochet a future for both of us in her head. I even convinced my parents to fund my Harvard law degree across the pond and postpone the marriage for a couple of years, explaining that I would be back as soon as I graduated to take Louisa as my wife. But the truth was, the day I turned 21 and was shipped to Boston was the last time I set foot on British soil. The last time my father saw me. It was the perfect betrayal, really. I used his wealth and connections until I didn't need them anymore. An advanced law degree from an Ivy League school was sufficient capital to bag a $400K a year partnership at one of the biggest law firms in Boston. By my third year, I tripled that amount, including bonuses. And now? Now I was a self-made millionaire. My life was mine, to lead, to rule, and to cock up. And the only dumbwaiter I was stuck in was deep in my head. The voices from my past still echoed inside it, reminding me that love was nothing but a middle-class affliction.
Chapter 1. Present Day. Bell. "Uterine malformation," I repeated numbly, staring back at Dr. Bjorn. I felt ridiculous. In my tight red leather pencil skirt and cropped white shirt, one leg flung over the other, my high-heeled Prada sandals dangling from my toes. Everything about me screamed woman. Everything other than the fact that apparently I couldn't have children.
"That's what the ultrasound indicated."
My OBGYN gave me a sympathetic look, somewhere between a flinch and a grimace.
"We ordered the MRI to confirm the diagnosis."
It was peculiar that the thing I thought about in that moment wasn't the implication of my condition, but rather how profoundly and oddly hairy Dr. Bjorn was. Like a teacup Pomeranian. Though not half as cute, he appeared to be in his early 60s, salt and pepper hair covering most of him. From his bushy eyebrows and wild mane to the fluffy tufts on his fingers. his chest hair curled out of his green scrubs like he was hiding a chia pet. "Explain to me what it means again. Uterine malformation?" I cupped my knee, sending him a lip-glossed smile. He shifted in his seat, clearing his throat.
"Well, your diagnosis is uterine septum, the most common form of uterine malformation. This is actually good news. We're familiar with it and can treat it in various ways. Your uterus is partially divided by a muscle wall, which puts you at a risk of infertility, repeated miscarriages, and premature birth. You can see it right here."
He pointed at the ultrasound photo between us. I wasn't in the mood to make direct eye contact with my failure of a uterus, but I looked anyway. Infertility. I wasn't in the habit of parroting people's words, but what the shit? Infertility? I was barely 30. I had at least 5 more years to make gorgeous, memorable mistakes with random men before I needed to think about having babies.
"Correct."
Dr. Bjorn nodded, still mesmerized by my lack of emotion. Didn't he know I had none?
"Paired with your PCOS, it could be an issue. I am happy to discuss the next steps with you."
Wait. I raised a hand, waving my red-tipped French manicure back and forth. Go back to that abbreviation. PC what?
PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome. It says in your file that you were diagnosed at 15.
Right. Things were a bit hazy when I got to the hospital that time. I'm guessing it's not good either, I deadpanned. He swiped a thumb on his phone. To me, it was a low point in my life, but to him, it was just another Wednesday.
It could cause more infertility issues.
Great. My womb gave Monica from Friends a run for her money. I wanted to pick a fight. I turned my wrath toward Dr. Bjorn. What does it even mean? I huffed. Isn't uterine malformation an issue that develops over the course of a pregnancy? With another apologetic smile, Dr. Bjorn turned to the screen in front of him and frowned, his bushy eyebrows high-fiving one another. He clicked his mouse to scroll through my medical history. Stupid mouse with stupid-sounding clicks.
"It does say that you had a spontaneous abortion at the age of 15.
A spontaneous abortion. Like I decided to go to coffee with a friend. Dr. Bjorn looked so embarrassed that I was surprised he didn't dig a hole in the carpet and disappear to the bottom floor. His eyes asked me if it was true. His mouth did not. He knew the answer. "Oops," I smiled grimly. "That's right. Must have forgotten. It was a busy year." Dr. Bjorn stroked his furry arm.
"Look, I know this is overwhelming."
I let out a throaty laugh. "Please, Doc, spare me the 'we're here for you' leaflet speech and let's get down to business. What are my options?"
"You have plenty of options,"
he announced, perking up. This he could work with. Solutions, facts, science.
"There are ways to ensure your future parenthood, if you are interested in becoming a mother, of course."
I was tempted to say no. I wasn't about the changing diapers or waxing poetic about stick figure drawings life. That motherhood was a force of disempowerment for women in a highly patriarchal society. To some extent, I even believed this post-feminist ideology. After all, I was a self-employed business owner whose life ambition was to piss people off. I would smash a pickle jar on the floor and eat it, glass and all, before I'd ask a man to open it for me. But I couldn't get the words out of my mouth. The truth was, I did want to become a mother, with every fiber of my being. It wasn't sophisticated or ambitious or noteworthy, but it was true. Which was why, a few weeks ago, I had paid my first visit to Dr. Bjorn to ensure my reproductive system was in pristine order and ready to go whenever I decided to go for it. Needless to say, it wasn't. "Yeah," I shrugged noncommittally. "I am, I guess." Dr. Bjorn cocked his head and frowned. He tried to decipher why exactly I was behaving this way. Like he was trying to sell me solar panels and I was blowing him off. Was I not an environmentalist?
In that case, the first stage is to freeze your eggs.
I shot him a sweet, impatient smile.
Are you planning to carry your future children to term?
He asked.
Can I evacuate them during the second trimester?
I yawned, checking my nails. Don't babies need to be fully cooked?
What I mean is, your age should be one of your considerations. Each passing year, the risk of a miscarriage or premature birth rises.
What are you saying, exactly? I pressed.
You may want to consider surrogacy if you plan to have children later in life. Ideally, and considering the complications, if you're ready, you should try to get pregnant right away. But ultimately, I don't want you to feel rushed.
A little too late for that, boo. I went from having 5 years to being tossed onto the highway of motherhood the minute he said that, because, again, what the shit? This wasn't my life. I was supposed to wait until 35, choose a hunky sperm donor. I was even going to splurge and get the really expensive membership to the sperm bank so I could see pictures of these potential men, then pop out a couple kids and create my own mini family. Next month seems like a good time to get pregnant, I heard myself say. Let me see if I can move my waxing appointment.
Miss Penrose,
Dr. Bjorn chided, standing up to pour me a glass of water. He handed it to me. I gulped it in one go.
I know it's not the news you wanted to hear. You don't have to be brave here. It's okay to be upset.
This, of course, was untrue. Breaking down was a privilege other people had. I was programmed to be fearless. Life threw curveballs at me left and right. I'd glided past them like a cartoon character with a smile on my face. I picked up my Chanel tote from the floor. If I need to get pregnant this year, I will. No man? No problem. I'll get a sperm donor. I hear they're tall, smart, and good with numbers. What more can you ask for in a baby daddy? I let out a metallic laugh, standing up. The OBGYN remained seated, still staring at me in complete shock. Yeah, I know. I'm heartless, emotionless, and as of 5 minutes ago, clinically wombless, too.
Don't you want to think about it?
He asked. There's nothing to think about. Time's working against me. I'll get a sperm donor and get it done. I also didn't have the kind of money it took to use a surrogate. Plus, becoming pregnant was a part of the deal. In the past few years, I'd watched my friends and sister popping out kids like they were Pez dispensers, sporting round, beautiful bellies and eccentric cravings and giddy smiles as they mulled over the eternal question, pastel paint or wallpaper for the nurseries. I wanted all those things. Every single one of their mundane, trivial experiences. Other than one. The husband. Getting married wasn't in my plans. Men were volatile, untrustworthy, and above all, a danger to me.
Well, in that case,
Dr. Bjorn reached his hand out for me to shake.
I'm prescribing you with 50 milligrams of clomiphene. You should take it starting the second day of your menstrual cycle, the month you intend to get pregnant. 5 pills, one for every day for 5 days, to be taken at the same hour. Stay hydrated and watch your cycle. Ovulation tests are going to be your new best friend. When you find your perfect donor, let me know. I want to read through their medical history to see if they're a fit for you.
Wonderful. I turned around, swaggering my way out of the room, bolting before he managed to sneak in another grave diagnosis about my body. I waved the receptionist goodbye and got out of the building without any memory of doing so. I guess I was having an out-of-body experience. I advanced toward my sporty BMW when my cell phone rang. I fished it out of my handbag. It was my sister, Percy. Hey, Purse, I greeted her warmly, no hint of distress in my voice. Pretending I had my shit together was an art form I'd perfected long ago. Hey, Belle, where am I catching you?
Just got out of the OBGYN.
Nothing like having your insides poked by a complete stranger with a magnifying glass, she sighed with what I suspected was genuine longing. Dang, she and her husband Killian were kinky. Everything okay down there? I heard my nephew, Aster, making exploding sounds in the background. He loved imagining shit was blowing up when he was playing Legos. That kid was becoming 99% tyrant, and I was here for it. Auntie needed brand new icebreakers, and having a dictator nephew was a great conversation topic. My vag is in immaculate condition for someone who is overworked and underpaid. I slid my designer sunglasses up my nose, strutting along the street. You need anything? My sister and I spoke at least 4 times a day, but she didn't normally ask me where I was. Maybe she wanted me to babysit Aster. Now that she had a newborn, baby Quinn, the most handsome little dude on planet Earth, she often needed a helping hand. Nope. Mom is coming over to take care of the kids. Killian is taking me on a date. Our first since Quinn was born. I just had this weird urge to call you to make sure you're okay. I don't know what came over me, my sweet, intuitive baby sister lamented. Persephone, Percy Fitzpatrick, was everything I wasn't. Romantic, maternal, and a rule follower. Oh, and the wife of the richest man in America. No big deal. I came to a halt, propping a hand against a red-bricked wall. Salem Street sprawled in front of me in all its summer glory, sprinkled with bakeries, colorful cafes, and flowers spilling from hung baskets. No, Purse, you were exactly right. I needed to hear your voice. Uneasy silence filled my ears. When Percy realized I wasn't going to elaborate on why I needed to hear her voice, she said, Is there anything I can do for you, Belle? Anything at all? Can you have a baby for me? Can you fix my uterus? Can you erase my past, which screwed me up so thoroughly, so exhaustively that I can no longer trust anything or anyone other than myself? Just hearing your voice is enough. I smiled. Love you, Belle. Right back at you, Purse. I slipped the phone back into my bag, smiling nonchalantly as though nothing was amiss. And then I felt my cheeks wet with furious, unstoppable tears. Was I full-blown crying in the middle of a busy main street? You bet your ass I was. Bawling was more like it. Gasping for air worked, too. My tears were bitter and hot, full of self-pity and fresh anger. The unfairness of my situation made my breath catch. Why was this happening? Why me? I wasn't a bad person. Actually, I was a pretty kick-ass one. I donated to charities and babysat my friends' kids and always bought Girl Scout cookies, even the Lemon Ups, which, let's admit it, were so bad they should have been illegal in all 50 states. Why was having a child going to be more difficult for me? If it was even possible, when everyone around me fell pregnant whenever their husbands so much as asked them to pass the salt. Dejected, anxious, and confused, I stumbled straight into the temple. No, not the place where you pray. A place called Temple Bar. Getting drunk in broad daylight might not be the smart thing to do, but it sure was comforting. Plus, I needed to pregame before going to a party tonight, and I was definitely partying tonight. I pushed the door open, stomped into the bar, and ordered a tall glass of whatever the hell would get me drunk in record time. An aftershock and a glass of wine coming right up, the bartender saluted, snapping a polishing cloth over his shoulder and pulling a steam-filled glass from the dishwasher. I slumped on a bar stool, massaging my temples as I tried to process my new reality. It was either have a baby now, or pretty much never. Tourists and professionals lounged in green wooden booths, enjoying pints of Guinness, coddles, and Irish stews. Irish folk songs belted from the speakers, jolly and full of mirth. Didn't the world know I was hurting? The place looked like an authentic Irish pub, with ornate high ceilings and liquor-soaked walls. The bartender came back with my drinks before I could burst into spontaneous tears. I hadn't cried since I was 5, maybe 6, and I wasn't going to start turning on the waterworks regularly now that I've found out I had to get pregnant at 30 while financially insecure. I downed the aftershock in one go, slamming the glass on the counter and moving straight to the wine. A tall, dark, and handsome type appeared in my periphery. He propped an elbow against the bar, his body tilted in my direction.
"Aren't you Emmabelle Penrose?"
"Aren't you a middle-aged man with enough life experience to know better than interrupt people when they're trying to get drunk?" I snapped, ready for another round. He chuckled.
"Feisty, just like I thought you'd be. I wanted to say I appreciate your business model. And your ass. Both look great hanging from a billboard in front of my building."
He leaned forward, about to whisper in my ear. I swiveled on my stool, grabbing his wrist in a death grip and twisting it down, rotating his entire arm in the process, on the verge of breaking it. He let out a moan, squeezing his eyes shut.
"What the fuck?"
It was my turn to lean toward him. "The fuck is? I'm trying to enjoy my drink here without getting sexually harassed. Think it'd be too much to ask? My being an owner of a burlesque club doesn't give you permission to try and feel me up. Just like if you were a dentist, it wouldn't give me the authority to lie on your dinner table at a restaurant and ask you to fill my cavity. Now beat it." I pushed the guy, sending him careening across the bar, back to his stool, spitting out profanity in his wake. He grabbed his coat and stormed out of the bar.
"Whoa. Is your day as bad as the hangover you're going to have tomorrow morning?"
The bartender grinned at me impishly. He looked to be in his mid-20s, with ginger hair and a shamrock tattoo on his forearm. "My day's worse than any alcohol poisoning recorded on planet Earth." I smacked my wine glass on the bar. "Trust me."
"Do not trust her. She's a flighty one."
A posh English accent chuckled three stools down. The person it belonged to was shadowed in the depth of the bar, a stain of darkness concealing his elegant silhouette. I didn't have to squint to know who it was. Only one man in Boston sounded like power, smoke, and an impending orgasm. Say hello to Devin Whitehall. Also known as the bastard who broke my strict one-night-only rule. He'd made it to a third hookup before I came to my senses and cut him loose. From the moment we jumped each other's bones about 3 years ago at my brother-in-law Killian's cottage in the woods, I knew Devin Whitehall was different. He was a dangerously mild creature, the scholar out of his group of friends, manipulative, arrogant, and in a league of his own. Other men around him had glaring shortcomings. Killian, my brother-in-law, was a cold fish in a suit. Hunter, my best friend's husband, was loose-tongued and goofy. And Sam, my friend Ashling's husband, was, well, a mass murderer. But Devin had no giant neon sign warning you to stay away. He wasn't damaged or broken or angry, at least not outwardly. Still, he had that same untouchable quality that made you want to burn like a meteor, which would inevitably reduce you to nothing but cinders. He was everything a woman wanted, wrapped into one godlike package. And that package had a state-of-the-art body down to the corded Michelangelo's Moses forearm muscles that made my IQ drop to room temperature whenever I touched them. I had to put a stop to our rendezvous after the third hookup, on the grounds that I wasn't an idiot. I always like to say that where there's a willy, there's a way. But in Devin's case, he looked like the kind of dude I could actually catch feelings for. That hookup, after we had had animalistic sex, Devin turned around, dropped his head on the pillow next to me, and did something outrageous and vulgar. He fell asleep.
What do you think you're doing?
I'd asked, appalled. What's next? Taking me to dinner? Matching Minnie and Mickey hoodies? Binge-watching Schitt's Creek together?
Sleeping,
he'd said in his patient, everyone around me is an idiot tone. His eyes, blue and silvery like molten ice, blinked open. A devilish smirk formed on his lips. I sat upright, glaring.
Go sleep in your own bed, bro. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I have an early court day tomorrow, and please do not use the term bro. Excessive use of common monikers is indicative of poor linguistic culture.
Cool story, bro. Do you have a version of that sentence in English? And then, because I really was tired, I said, never mind. Just get out of here.
Are you taking the mic?
He wore a blank expression like it was a full-blown tux. Out. I had marched over to the door and tossed out his clothes and loafers. He stumbled out half-naked in my hallway, collecting the designer items from the floor. Truth be told, it wasn't my finest exhibition of character. I was overwhelmed with throat-clogging fear that I would get attached. Now, Devin was in front of me, all tall and gorgeous and screwable. I caught his frame on the fringe of my sight, hands in pockets, square jaw as sharp as a blade. Calling me untrustworthy is libel, Mr. Hotshot Lawyer. I puckered my lips, slipping into the role of the ball-busting siren. I wasn't in the mood to be quick-witted, eccentric Belle, but that was the only version of me people knew.
Actually, it is slander. Libel is when the false accusation is written. I could text it to you if you're so inclined.
He turned to the bartender, tossing a black Amex card on the counter.
One stinger for me and a Tom Collins for the lady.
Why, yes, His Highness, the bartender flustered. Sir, what should I call you?
Devin quirked an eyebrow.
I would honestly prefer if you didn't. You're here to serve me drinks, not hear my life story.
With that, the bartender was off to grab our drinks. I don't see a lady anywhere in this vicinity, I mumbled into my glass of Chardonnay.
There's one right behind you, and she's quite fit.
He deadpanned, face stoic. One of the good things about Devin Whitehall, and unfortunately there were many, was that he never took himself seriously. After I had shamefully banished him from my bed, he had stopped calling me. The next time we'd met, however, at a Christmas party, he had hugged me warmly, asked how I was doing, and even showed interest in investing in my club. He'd behaved as if nothing happened, and to him, I guess nothing had. I didn't know why Devin had never married, but I suspected he suffered from the same relationship phobia I was prone to. Over the years, I'd watched him parade one woman after another. They were all leggy, stylish, and held degrees in subjects I could hardly pronounce. They also had the shelf life of an avocado. Devin never tried to get with me again, but remained wryly fond of me, the way you were fond of the childhood blanket you used to snuggle with but would not be caught dead in the same room with it anymore. These days, he made me feel chronically undesirable.
What's got your niggers in such a twist?
He asked, running his fingers through his thick hair, streaks of cool wheat and gold. I wiped my eyes quickly. Go away, Whitehall.
Darling girl, your chances of evacuating an Englishman from a bar on a Friday afternoon are slim to none. Any requests I can actually fulfill?
The casual benevolence rolling off of him made me nauseous. No one was supposed to be that perfect.
Die in hell?
I pressed my forehead to the cool bar. I didn't mean it. Devin had only ever given me good conversation, compliments, and orgasms, but I was really upset. He slipped onto the stool next to me, flicking his wrist to check his Rolex. I knew he wouldn't answer me. Sometimes he treated me like an 8-year-old. Our drinks arrived. He pushed the Tom Collins my way, handing my glass of Chardonnay back to the bartender quietly.
Here now. This'll make you feel better. And then significantly worse, but since I won't be there to deal with the consequences.
He gave a careless shrug. I took a sip and shook my head. I'm not good company right now. You'd have a better time striking up conversation with the bartender or one of the tourists.
Darling, you're barely civilized and still better company than anyone in this zip code.
He gave my hand a quick but warm squeeze. Why are you nice to me? I demanded.
Why not?
Again, he sounded completely at ease. I've been nothing but horrible to you in the past. I thought about the night I threw him out of my apartment, panicked that he'd somehow find a crack in my heart, pry it open, and sneak into it. The fact that he was here pragmatic and unbothered, just proved that he had heartbreak written all over him.
That's not how I remember our brief but joyous history, he sipped his stinger.
I kicked you out.
My arse has suffered worse,
he offered a dismissive flick of his wrist. He had nice hands. He had nice everything.
No need to take it personally.
What do you take personally?
Not many things in life, to be honest,
he frowned, giving it genuine thought.
Corporate taxes, perhaps.
It's essentially double taxation, an outrageous concept, you must admit. I blinked slowly at him, wondering if I was beginning to see a hint of imperfection in the man everyone looked up to. Under the layers of manners and chiseled looks was, I suspected, a truly odd man. You care about taxes, but not that I humiliated you? I challenged.
Amabel, love.
He gave me a smile that would make ice melt.
Humiliation is a feeling. One must submit to it in order to experience it. You've never humiliated me. Was I disappointed that our affair had run its course faster than I had wanted it to? Sure, but it was your right to end things at any given moment.